Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Dan. Thank you all for coming. It's a real honor to be here with been a stellar lineup of speakers over the years, and I'm very honored to be selected to come here to speak to you. I have to say that I was listening to James Lockyer's remarks from last month, where he said that he was a bit radical in the 70s, and he decided he was probably still pretty radical. And I always remember being told that the older you get, the more radical you get. And that must be true, because this book steps out into an area that's fairly controversial, I think. It may be just that at our age, we begin to speak more about what we're thinking in radical terms. So this book is the premise of the book. I'll just lay it out at the start. You will be, some of you, very skeptical, I think. But I've had a lot of experience in the prison system, and I have also done a lot of research about what goes on in Western countries elsewhere. And what we do in Canada does not do us proud. I think that in general terms, we can run a criminal justice system that houses in a humane way those who are very dangerous, and there are some. I've met hundreds of prisoners, and I could count on both hands, more or less, the ones that I really had to keep my distance from and that I knew I never wanted to see back on the street. There are those. But the rest of them, with a lot of assistance and a lot of commitment, don't have to be warehoused at a cost to the taxpayer of well over $100,000 per year in the federal system, and considerable amount of money per year in our provincial and territorial systems. So if for no other reason, if it doesn't tug at your heartstrings what I'm about to say and suggest might be a better system, think about the money, because the money could be better spent. And I don't think it could have been put better than by Kevin Page, who is here, the former parliamentary budget officer, who, when he dipped into some of the new legislation coming down from the Harper government, was amazed at how expensive a proposition our criminal justice system is, that we spend close to $3 billion every year housing about 14,000 federal inmates. Just blew him away. He said, if you're putting that kind of money down and investing that kind of money in any enterprise, you want to know that you're getting something out of it, that you're producing a decent product, you know, that you're getting a good result. And I think it's pretty clear, I say this with a bit of trepidation, but I think it's fairly clear that we're not getting the result we need to be getting from our system. I think what we're getting is a number of people coming out of prison really bitter, angry at the way they've been treated while they were there, at the length of time they've been sent there, given what they might have done, and especially when they see what kind of alternatives exist elsewhere. And I'll get to those in a moment. If I speak too quickly, throw something at me or something so that I can be sure that you're hearing what I'm saying. So I want to start by just giving you a couple of little examples of what works in criminal justice and does so in a way that's humane and decent and pays attention to human rights as well as to the rule of law. In Manitoba, there's a small reserve called Hollow Water near Winnipeg, and about 50 years ago, it was in a dire situation. About 100% of the population had been either abused as children, sexually abused as children or as adults, or had perpetrated such an offense, or had done both. 70% unemployment. It was very unhealthy, dysfunctional, and hopeless kind of a situation. A few people there got their acts together, sobered up basically, went looking for help, found, now this is the interesting part to me, this is in Canada, had they been dealt with in the normal routine, most of that reserve would have been in prison and probably in a penitentiary for what had happened there. So there was a judge located and a set of Crown attorneys located who were prepared to try something different, which never happens in criminal justice. We don't do different. We do Eurocentric, traditional, adversarial courtroom and then prison, and that's what we do. So they found these folks who were prepared to think about it differently, and what they did was institute a type of restorative justice, which I'm sure you've heard of by now. It's a process that takes you away from the system I've just described of adversarial, fighting it out, duking it out in a courtroom, and it puts the offender in a room with the victim or victims and with the community and with anybody that might have an interest, and they sit and talk until they come up with a system that will work for them all, which involves the accused confessing to what happened and expressing his sorrow or her sorrow at what happened, and trying to find a way of making reparations or doing something for the community to restore the harmony and the traditional circle that is part of their indigenous system. And they did this, and it was highly successful. A lot of it had to do with the personalities involved. A lot of it had to do with the amount of resources put into the programming that you need to have to support a community like that and to lift them back up. You don't do that sort of thing alone. You need to have social workers and psychologists and facilitators and the whole nine yards in order to make something like that work. Well, they did. Now, I understand it's not working quite as well today because the personalities have changed, the money was pulled back, you know, the usual story. But what an illustration of a decent, humane way of dealing with everybody in a situation like that. And as a result, a very few actually did end up having to do some time in prison, but most of them did not. So they were able to remain in their communities and continue building what they had started there. Of the 107 people who were finally found to have been guilty of having carried on these offenses, only two of the people who remained in the community without ever doing any prison time, only two of them ever reoffended. That is a remarkable result, and we sure don't get that with our prison system. They come out, and within 2 years, you're finding it at least, depends on the numbers. You see, the corrections service has their numbers, and then other people have theirs. But anywhere from 20 to 40% reoffend within 2 years coming out of the prison system. Okay, so I say to you, how is it possible that we did that once in a place in remote Manitoba, and nobody's picked up on that model, virtually nobody? I won't say nobody's doing restorative justice, because they are, but it's very ad hoc. As far as I know, the only province that has actually instituted it as a normal way to proceed is Nova Scotia, and it's doing a good job at it, I think. So we know what works. We know how to do this. We know how to get a good result. You can be sure it didn't cost what it would have cost to prosecute all of those people and warehouse them for years. So again, I ask the question, I know that Western countries around, you know, Western developed countries are working very hard, most of them, to reduce the numbers of people incarcerated. It's not even hard to do, and I will tell you how to do it in a minute. And yet we, if I'm, I may be missing something, but I've never heard a Canadian government take a position about reducing the numbers, much less closing prisons down. And we can be doing that. Yes, they closed Kingston Penitentiary. They had to close it before it fell down. It was 170 some years old. But all of those people went to other prisons and they built new prison cells. Well, that's not much of an advance, is it? The other story that I wanted to tell at the outset, is an American story, but it really recommends itself to me. This happened a few years ago, quite a few years ago, but a fellow called Jerry Miller was put in charge of the entire young offenders set of facilities in Massachusetts. And at the time, there were 1,000 youngsters closely confined in those facilities. 4 years later, there were 40 people left, 40 kids left in custody. The other 960 had been given a program to follow, given this, whatever supervision was required, given all of the social assistance that was needed in their particular case, and went back on the street. And a Harvard follow-up research paper showed that there wasn't even a blip in the crime rate. It didn't cause any more crime. And so I would say the other way of speaking about this is that nearly 1,000 children were in prison for nothing. And they were being tortured in those facilities. I won't go into the details, but you can imagine what the conditions might have been like. He went on to another facility in Philadelphia somewhere, and I'm telling you this one because I think this is good, a good plan and would work for us. In this one, it was young offenders, and what they had was a panel of people who had a decision to make as to whether these children needed to be in custody or go on probation. Those were the two options available at the time. When Dr. Miller arrived, he did a very simple thing and provided them with a third alternative. And the alternative was to provide each child with a personal plan, with the very personalized things that kid might need, whether it was a learning disability or a drug abuse thing or a mental diagnosis, whatever it might be, everything he needed to live on the outside. And again, within days or weeks, the panel that had been sending 90% of the kids in front of them to prison were sending them to this alternative program. That, again, is a remarkable result, and we can be doing that and should be doing something like that. I think we put people in prisons just because it's what we know. We've always had prisons for centuries. They seemed like a good idea at the time because the alternative was horrible torture or hanging or, you know, something really physically awful. So prison seemed like a progressive thing to do, I'm sure. But you can see, you know what it's developed into. It's still torture for anybody that's in segregation or for anybody with a guard on his case or for anybody that's in a room full of people that want him dead, which happens a lot. It's torture. And it's physical, but it's also very mental torture, so that by the time you've done a serious stretch in a serious prison, you're really not in any shape to come out on the street and figure out how to live your life and be part of your community again. You don't even know how to work the internet, you know, because our prisons are stopping people from having access, and they're stopping people from having cell phones so they can talk to their families. Sure, they could be running a drug deal from there, yeah. But other countries don't have that problem. They have their people who are in custody, have access to these things. So what you're doing is you're, first of all, making their lives miserable while they're inside. But once they're out, they don't even know how to deal with the new technologies and the new changes that have happened in their absence. So we're doing it all wrong in that respect. And in case you think it's just me talking, I'll just refer to Madame Justice Louise Arbour, who is only, I think, one of the most amazing jurists on the planet and highly respected everywhere. When Kingston Penitentiary for Women had a bad incident in the 90s, she was chosen to do the inquiry. And so she had a lot of the corrections staff in front of her, and she questioned them all and then wrote her report. And in her report, she said a couple of things that really stuck with me. One was that prison, which is supposed to be our solution for everything, is the opposite of that. She said that it's the antithesis of justice. And that makes you sit back when somebody of her caliber says that. So where does that then take you? Does that not take you to, let's do something else? Let's do something differently? The other thing that she remarked on after speaking with any number of people from the system who work in the system was that this is a culture, it's an ugly culture, it's brutalizing, so it's not even good for the people that work there. It's brutalizing to the guards. I saw how awful it was for them. They have a PTSD rate that's four times the rate of people coming back from the Afghan war. And their suicide rates are through the roof, and their domestic violence rates are through the roof. It's an ugly job. It's an ugly place to work. Prisons are just plain ugly. And so she was saying that the culture, that's the culture, and from what I've seen, that culture will not change no matter what you do. The only thing she could think of was a court order. Every time you want to change something, you're going to have to take them to court. Well, that's fine, and then you get the court order, and then you have to figure out how you're going to make those people obey it. And it's not a simple task. So I'm suggesting that that's evidence, at least for me, that we actually are doing things really badly in this regard, and that it is a matter of public safety. And that if you want people coming out of prison safely, you need to deal with them as human beings. That's the first thing. But I would like to go much, much further and start closing them down. So that's where I'm going with this book and with what I'm going to be saying to you. I guess it should be said right too at the outset that we all have heard that if you want to be able to figure out what level of civilization a nation has achieved, look at the prisons. We don't come off very well, I can tell you, so. We have principles of sentencing set out in our criminal code that tell us what we're supposed to achieve when we sentence wrongdoers. And I would like to posit that all of these objectives are achievable without imprisoning people. So if we want to denounce a particular act, a particular terrible deed, that is done the minute it hits the press, the minute the word goes out. It doesn't require someone to be behind bars in order to achieve denunciation. The one that most people feel is important to sending people to prison is that it will deter that person from ever offending again, and it will deter other people from doing something similar. But again, we know that that doesn't work, and I can tell you, most of my clients weren't thinking about the consequences when they did whatever it was they did. They just were spontaneous, and boom, they did it. It was too late to take it back, and away we go. They don't know if they're looking at 10 years or life or what. So deterrence isn't even an issue for the person in the case. For others who might be watching what's happening, again, they're not thinking about what's going to be happening to them if they were to do the same thing. And similarly, if you have people who plan, who aren't spontaneous, but actually, you know, organize crime, plan the hit and the rest of it, whatever it might be, they're planning, the first order of their plan is not to get caught. So they're not thinking how long they're going to get. If they do get caught, they're thinking, I'm good to go here. I'm not going to get caught. So it's, deterrence is a funny animal, and we know the studies actually show that deterrence doesn't work. Long sentences definitely don't work. What does work is if a potential offender thinks there's a likelihood of getting caught. That's the one thing that might make somebody think twice. Incapacitation is another reason we use for putting people in prison. That means that when you send somebody to prison, they just broke and entered your house. He can't do that if he's behind bars. Well, that's true, but give it a little thought, because you have to think about what happens when you put someone in prison. And let's say the big news of the day is the drug kingpins. Say they're trying to take down the big drug movers of drugs. And the moment you take out somebody like El Chapo, you create a war, because so many ambitious young criminals are getting ready to move into that position. So you can actually make the position worse by putting somebody in prison. That's number one. Number two is, once they're in prison, the offending doesn't end there. If he's assaulted somebody, the chances are in prison are very good that there's going to be a fair bit of assault going on, and he may be participating. So the fact that the assault might be against another prisoner is not an excuse for not recognizing that the violence continues. And finally, when he gets released, if he's treated in the way that I've been describing, he's going to be an unhappy camper when he gets out. He's going to have a lot of bitterness and anger, and it leads to the levels of recidivism that I've talked about. So incapacitation doesn't sell itself to me as a good reason for prison either. Rehabilitation. I don't know what to say about how in the world, in an atmosphere of a prison, you can hope to provide programs, even if you're serious about it. And, you know, mostly they're really not, at least in my experience. If they've got grade 8, and most of them do, or half of them do, give them an education. But, you know, you can't get an education system going. People move into the system, move out of the system. They're not happy there. They're not serious about it. And the place, the institution, is often like a tuning fork. You're looking for your back. You're watching out for the guy that you just heard has a shank in his hand ready to go for you. That's how you spend your time. You're worried. You're nervous. You haven't seen your family for years, maybe. How can you learn anything? How can you sit and talk about your feelings in an anger management course, you know? If you're going to do rehabilitation, do it outside. Don't do it in the prisons. Do those programs where they're needed. And get the programs up front. Get in front of the problem. Before the offense is committed, have the programs there. Help the kid with dyslexia, you know, help the kid with the drug problem. Do something for the mentally diagnosed issues. It's not rocket science, and everybody else seems to be able to do it, but we just don't seem to have the commitment in Canada to be doing that. And the other two are reasons for sentencing are to provide reparations. Well, of course, if you're in prison, you're not working, you're not going to do that. So that's not even a sensible way to get there. And the other is recognition of responsibility. Now, it's hard to recognize responsibility in a place where you have no responsibility for anything. You don't have a job, you don't have, you know, anything to do, and you're not learning how to be responsible, and there's really no way to express your feeling of responsibility from there to the victim or your community. So all of those are the reasons why we sentence people, and based and paramount over it all is the requirement by the criminal code that you try everything but prison first. It's only supposed to be a last resort. It's the very worst thing you can do to an offender. And for my money, it's the place they go first. That's the first place a court goes, is for a prison sentence, if it's available. And it's certainly the case with Indigenous offenders. And that's a shocking thing, because we have special legislation requiring that a judge give a moment to the fact that there's a background here for Indigenous people that has to be taken into account. Boy, I'm going to have to rush a little bit, I think, here. Time flies when you're having fun. Okay. I'm going to talk about this in a sequence, I think, and try to move a little bit more quickly. The first thing is, a lot of people who argue for prison abolition think that you are selling out if you talk about how to reform the system. And I'm not one of those. I think that while we still have prisons and people in them living a horrible life and with not many prospects, we need to be trying to make it as livable as we can until we can fix things and stop sending so many people to prison. So we need to alleviate the conditions within the prison. We could at least train the staff so that they have some expertise, even in psychology. That's what they're doing in Europe. You know, give them the university course in psychology and management of personnel and all kinds of really sophisticated stuff. But that only works if you've got a system where a guard will actually have a conversation with a prisoner. Now, we had a situation in the 90s with a commissioner who was from Europe, Ole Ingstrup, who was in favor of this approach. They call it dynamic security. And the idea is that the staff are there to help these guys and women learn how to live and how to rectify the problems that they have and so forth. And they can even become friends. They're allowed to become friends. Today, and when I was practicing, so much the contrary that it was like, it really was an us versus them. It was really ugly. There was no love lost anywhere. There was no courtesy. There was no respect. There was no dignity offered to these people. And that produces riots. You know, it produces really bad situations in which people die. So that has to happen. And one of the things would be then to train the staff to make it possible for them to do that kind of work and then allow them to do it when they get there. I was reminded of Robert Clark, who I think was invited to speak here and wasn't able to for some reason, but his book called Down Inside describes his 30 years as a prison guard and then worked his way up the system. When he finished, he wrote a book about it. And it's pretty enlightening, and I would encourage everybody here to read it because he talks about the things I'm saying now. And we're pretty much in agreement on a lot of it. But he talked about his training because, of course, you come out of grade 12 and you go to the whatever the course is, and it's a short course. And here's the kind of information he was given. They were training them to do cell extractions. It's like a tooth extraction, only it's, you know, you need the guy to get out of his cell and he doesn't want to come. So how do you go about getting him out of his cell? And Robert said, I was told, grab a leg and hang on. You know, that's the level of sophistication of what's going on in the Corrections Service Canada right now. And that, you know, high-level federal prisons, and that's as good as it gets. And he was quite disgusted by it, and so am I. And I think we need to go a long way in that respect in order to improve what's happening now. Okay, so the training and the programming and the conditioning, the conditions need to be alleviated a great deal. They need to start feeding people enough. They're giving people in the federal system right now the same calorie count for the young 20-year-old who's out pumping iron all day in the gym and the 50-year-old who's sitting in front of the TV all day. Can you imagine? I mean, these guys are even hungry. They're spending their very little amount of money that they make if they have a job on ramen noodles at the concession stand to fill up the empty spaces. I mean, that's not Canada in the 21st century, you know? It shouldn't be. So there are a lot of easy things that can be done right now to make life a little better for the people who are inside. Okay, so the next stage that I'm going to suggest, though, it's a horrible word, decarceration, obvious what it means. But all of these countries I'm talking about have specifically decided that they want fewer people in prison. And we can even refer to the United States right now, which really surprises me. There are over 2 million people in custody down there. It's breaking the treasuries of the states. They don't know what to do because they have no money, and you know, all these guys are going into prison. So they're finding ways to just amnesty people out. Anybody who's on a, you know, nonviolent, no-victim, first-timer who got 20 years, he's done two, he's out. They're just sending them home, you know. They're changing the law so that that some offenses that have been thought of as very serious, like, I don't know, smoking marijuana, are no longer so serious anymore, so those guys can all go home. And it's hundreds and hundreds, and in some cases the courts have ordered them to reduce their numbers by thousands because of medical issues. They can't provide the health care for the people, they can't provide security in there. The prisoners are running the prison, which is true anyway. It's really how it works. But anyway, decarceration needs to be happening, and it is easy to do. One of the things I thought would happen in the last session of government didn't. The mandate letter that went out to justice included a suggestion, I guess, or an order. It's a mandate, so it's an order to reduce the number of mandatory minimum sentences that we have. Easy. Change the legislation. You got a majority government. Get it done. Do it in the first year or nobody might notice. I know this is not a popular file in Ottawa or anywhere politically. You don't get votes working on this stuff unless you're tough on crime, which is actually stupid on crime, if I may be so bold. So you want to be smart on crime, which is not being soft on crime, it's being smart. And those sentences not only push up the price of criminal justice everywhere because they appeal and everybody goes to trial and nobody wants to face the sentence, it also means that people are languishing for extreme long periods of time and the judge has no discretion at all. You're giving the discretion to crown attorneys, police officers, people who aren't trained to make those kinds of decisions. We need to end drug prosecutions. You can read my book, but, you know, it's a waste. We're wasting our money. If we were to right now legalize everything, and I do give the government credit for legalizing marijuana because, you know, the only way to get on top of the problems associated with drugs, and including the violence, black market, organized crime, bad drugs that are adulterated with poisons, is if we can control them ourselves as a nation, as a public service. And you can't do that if they're not legal. So that's my little thing on drugs. But, I mean, there'd be a lot of people removed from the rolls in prison if we could do that. Up to anywhere from 15 to 25% of the offenses that appear on the Statistics Canada website as to how many police have charged with this are what we call administrative offenses. Those are offenses that do no harm to anyone. There's no victim, there's no violence, there's no nothing. What there is what's regarded as a flouting of the law. So you've been ordered to visit your probation officer every Monday between 9 and 5, and 1 week you miss. Boom. You're back in court, and the next step is prison. So that's those kinds of cases, we need to eliminate the possibility of prison for that sort of thing. That's a ridiculous way to deal with that sort of a problem. We have many other things we could be doing. The other one that has to stop is cash bail. More than half of the people in provincial prisons right now have bail and can't make bail. They don't have the money to put down. They don't know anybody who can sign as a surety for them. So they're stuck. And they sit in prison for months and sometimes years waiting to have a trial or to have something happen. We have to stop that practice of making cash the central point of bail, because otherwise we have thousands of people sitting in prison for nothing. And we need to reform the parole system, because that end of the system right now is causing a lot of bottleneck. they haven't been issuing parole for people for most of the Harper years. And I don't know, recently maybe it's improved, but they're just not releasing people. They're so risk averse that they simply can't make a decision to let somebody back on the street because, oh, what would happen if you reoffended and, you know, it would be all our fault. Well, it's going to happen. I mean, that will happen. So you have to use some judgment. That's what you're there for. That's what you're being paid for. So we'll see if any of those happen. And the final phase of this is what I'm just going to call closing the prisons and presenting alternatives to prison. Now, everyone will say this all costs so much money, you know, because what you have to do is put the programs in place ahead of the offense. You need to take those communities that are really having a tough time and really cruising, their kids are cruising for trouble, and you know where they are and who they are. And put the supports in place, the programs in place, and the people, lots of staff. Think about it. Everyone goes, oh, we closed the prisons, all those jobs. And I'm thinking, no. You'd be creating jobs because you'd have to deal with it sensibly on the street. And they'd be well-paid jobs. They'd be people who are highly trained and sophisticated and capable. Not a job as a keeper, you know, where you're gonna be brutalized in your job. These would be excellent jobs, and there'd be lots of money to pay for them because you wouldn't be pouring this kind of money into the prison system. The other number that I saw someplace was if you look at not just the prison system, but the lead up, all the courts and the police and the judges and the clerks and the paperwork and all of that that's involved in getting somebody to prison and then looking after them more or less in prison, you're talking $20 billion a year across provinces, territories, and the feds. That's, you know, we should be getting a result for that, and we're not. Where do the victims come in here? I haven't even said the word hardly. Big constituency, really important that we take care of them more than anything else, probably. Victims, as you know, are not a homogeneous group. You hear remarkable stories of victims saying, you've killed my boy, but I forgive you. You know, I understand where you came from, how this might have happened, and let's make sure that you're okay and your family's okay and my family's okay, and we'll just settle down. And these are victims who recognize, I think, that and say so, that the anger and hate that can result from having been badly harmed by an offender only perpetuates the wrong. It only makes things worse, and it ruins your whole life. It can ruin your whole life. So if you look at what victims' organizations say, they will tell you that far and away, victims are not vindictive or vengeful. They don't care if the guy goes away for 2 years or 20 years. Well, I guess they do care. They probably don't want the 20 years. What they say they want is to make sure that this kind of harm is never perpetrated against anybody else again. And they're ready to work for that. Now, that's astonishingly generous, I think. I don't know if I could do that. But they do, and that's who they are. And I think that we need to take our lead from them, because they understand that in order to stop the horrible cycle of violence, somebody has to take it in hand properly outside prisons and make sure that we've covered off the danger and that we've actually produced a human being who's going to be productive and contribute to his community and help and understand what's happening with others of his age and, you know, stage, because it's usually younger men who find themselves in behind bars for stupid things that they've done, or sometimes not so difficult. But okay, so I've already said, I've described a bit to you of restorative justice. These are the alternatives. If you can close down the prisons and start working with people on the outside, there are any number of approaches, but restorative justice has a big as an umbrella. It can be a sentencing circle. It can be a healing circle. It can be the Maori version, the family conferencing affair. It can be any number, and a lot of them very indigenous traditional approaches, very successful. The New Zealand approach, this Maori approach, has been very successful, and we've adopted a fair bit of it here. So we know how to do those things. The Gladue courts, which are the ones especially made for our indigenous population, are not succeeding. This is not happening in the way that was envisaged by the people who passed the legislation. We need to be expending a lot of energy on that one. We need to put money down for two areas. One, mental diagnoses, people with mental diagnoses. Some of our prisons, 40% of the population has a diagnosis. That's not the way it's supposed to work. Prison is not supposed to be the default position on mental illness. That's not right. And the other is with respect to drug abuse. We can deal with that on the street. We know that. Drug treatment courts have been more or less successful. You can do it that way if you want. But just generally educating people about drugs and dealing with it as a public health issue is important. There was an organization, and I'll quit shortly. COSA, COSA, Circles of Support and, help me out, Accountability, thank you, created for a particular group of offenders who are sexual predators or have committed a lot of sex assault. They are known, in the business anyway, as people who are likely to reoffend. And so we had to figure out what to do when they're released. They have to be released. Everybody gets released except, you know, Paul Bernardo, basically. But they're going to be on the street, so you have to figure out what to do. And this group was organized to basically surround a prisoner who was being released and have him come to the community and work there and live there and just keep an eye, treat him like a human being and a normal person in the community, and try to make sure nothing bad happens. And it was so successful. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was highly successful. So what did the Conservative government do? They shut it down, you know? It's not even hard to do. And amazingly, there are all kinds of people out there willing to participate and help with these programs. That, to me, that's so generous. Such a good Canadian kind of a thing to do. I've talked about the Aboriginal traditional approach, and I think I've said enough about that. And then the special courts. I will mention one more special court other than drug treatments and mental health courts. There's in Vancouver, they have this issue down on the downtown east side that reflects, repetitive behavior, okay? So people that just shoplift every time they walk in the store. People who insist on going down the street with all their stuff in a grocery cart trying to sell to people that go by. Apparently that's an offense there, I don't know. So what you get is a ticket, or for sleeping on a park bench, right? All the time. You get a ticket for that sort of thing, but the ticket, if you don't pay it, and nobody ever can, you go to prison. So this court is a special court where they invited the local businesses who have concerns about this kind of behavior. And they rounded up 14 businesses and a bunch of other people, and they've got a little court going, and they decide how to deal with these folks without them going to prison and without them having to come up with money somehow that they're never going to find. So those are very community-oriented, very grassroots approaches. What a shame that the powers that be in the country can't pick up on those and take them and run with them, you know? Give them the funding that they need so that they can do a good job and spread the word and establish satellite offices elsewhere. A change of government should not make any difference in this file. I would suggest this should be a nonpartisan issue. I would like you, when you all go home and send your email to your local MP, to just say that. You know, it doesn't matter who's in power. This is a situation that affects all of us, And there are ways that we know that work, then ways that don't, and let's use the ones that work. So if you look at Norway or the Netherlands has one prison left, one, and there were so few inmates there lately that they borrowed a few from Norway in order to justify keeping something open, because you need to have something, right? But, I mean, isn't that pathetic? And here we are with, how many people are in custody right now? Well, federally 14,000 and then another 30,000 in the provinces and territories. So, you know, for a little country like us, that doesn't make any sense either. So I'd like you to all go home and do your little emails too, because a lot of this is political, but a lot of it isn't. A lot of it is you volunteering to do things like Michael Enright last week on Sunday Edition, going in with classically trained musicians to Millhaven, you know, to play for these guys. They never get something like that. They felt like they had their dignity back for just that hour or two. What a simple thing to do. Why can't we be doing that? Largely we can't because the administration won't let us. Like, they're not going to necessarily let you waltz in there and do that, especially not with a radio crew. But, you know, there are lots of openings for people, and I'd like to see people trying a bit harder with respect to that. Final thing I want to say about the whole issue is that central to the whole process are attention and respect for human rights, and we're not doing that. And overarching that is we have to have the rule of law mean something, and I don't think we have that in a lot of our prisons. I think they pretty much are doing what they want to do. You can challenge me. I'm sure somebody in here will want to do that. But by and large, they're out of sight, out of mind, eh? You go to prison, I practiced in Toronto for a year, for my first year. Your clients were sent down to KP. You never heard of them again. And you never set foot in any of those prisons. You had, as a defense lawyer or a crown attorney or a judge, no idea what those people were facing. And I'll tell you one thing, once you know what they're facing, you really rethink how this system should work. I think that's what I want to say for the moment. I want to thank you for your rapt attention. Thank you.